Session number 10444.
Monsieur Maloubier, reel 2.
Well, this power station was built on one side of the River Seine, as I told you, by the foot of a huge hill, which is the Cantleu Hill, and the RAF couldn't reach it. Every time they missed it. And the weather was awful, especially in what they call it, sort of the melting pot of France as far as climate is concerned. So I spread around this power station fire pots that we have by the tongue, thermites, sort of to signal the position to the RAF. So what I did, I went there one night at about midnight, and there was a mosquito squadron was supposed to bomb this power station at midnight. So I went there about 11 o'clock. Sped all my thermites, and when I heard the with of course a fuse, and when I heard the mosquitoes far away, I just did two stem pots, and I ran as much as I could. Unfortunately, the weather was so bad they couldn't do anything at all. They passed by and left. So after that, this power station. Actually, they were on the underground. They were about about 200 German guards, a very heavy protection, German protection. So we can definitely hit it with it. We couldn't attack 200 people anyway, even if they were. Most of them were to shelters, So attacked the substation, which was on the other side of the Seine, made of switches and about five. Or six very huge transformers, which were actually feeding the Rouen industrial area and all the plants. So we did it on Sunday night, of course, with my team. Was my team. I had trained for this, and the chap who was Claude Malraux, who was the assistant to Staunton, and the brother of André Marnot, the younger brother André Marnot.
What was the date of this? Do you know?
Probably somewhere around October 1943, I think. So actually we succeeded, and we managed with my, what I knew about sabotage, to set aflame the transformers. That's quite a bit tricky business, so that your thermite is not blown off by the explosive, which actually puncture the transformers, and the hot oil has got to get to contact with the thermites at a time, so that the whole damn thing can be set afire, which happened actually. And that was rather fun in a way, because we left by bicycle, of course. That was about 11 o'clock in the morning. In at night, and I left just behind the Rouen Cathedral. And I passed by with my bicycle about, I should say, just before curfew, and just when I passed by this cathedral, there was a huge explosion. And another local terrorist, as they used it, just bombed out the Soldatenheim, which is the German mess on the cathedral, on the square. And of course, just a few minutes after, the whole damn place was surrounded by Germans checking up with every passerby. I mean, if I had been about 3 minutes later, I wouldn't be here anymore, of course, because I had, of course, in my bag, I had my stun gun, my Colt, my some of explosive left, and detonators and all this. Apparently, it was a question of a few, I should say, 1 or 2 minutes.
What target did you have to deal with after this?
After this, it was a steel plant, which is actually one of the large ones in France by a national company called Sidelor, I think. And same thing, I mean, we attacked it maybe in the November or December 1943, same scheme. I mean, we just destroyed the pumps, one of the big electric motors. And some of the machines there, I mean, it was put out of order, I think, for at least 6 months. And they were actually manufacturing some and the carriage for Focke-Wulf 990, I think, which was very important. This is why London wanted it to be destroyed. And then there was a submarine tender, which was actually refitted by the French Chantier de Normandie in Rouen. And the Royal Navy was very upset by this ship, which was a small ship, but always managed to go through the blockade by the Navy and get to the Atlantic or the Channel. And of course, refuel, not only refuel, but supply the submarines with whatever they needed, you know. It was not actually a tanker, it was a tender ship, you know, supplying food, water, whatever they needed, and byproducts. So we had, it was about 14 Frenchmen technicians and working on this ship, and one of these chaps was belonging to our radio and provided with a 3 pounds charge, which he managed to stick on the side, and this ship was sunk. Of course, there was always some fun with the Germans, I should say, because when the Navy, the experts of the Navy, came by after and said, well, we know very well that this bomb has been planted inside the ship. And especially, by chance, he was working on this part, which is in the side of the ship facing the quay, you know, the platform. And they said, well, so they arrested the 14th Frenchman and said, okay, you're going to be shot. There's no way. One of you has done it. And no one knew who he was anyway, because he hadn't talked to the chapter. Once I gave him this bomb, he had it in a small bag, he brought it. He was in search by the German sentries, we don't know why. Planted, he sunk this damn ship, you know. And then afterwards came the Gestapo, saying, this is our business. I mean, sabotage is our business. And they decided that the bomb was not planted inside but outside the hull. Simply, you know, because of the pressure of the bomb, the steel was pushed inside. Although this is just a question of the explosion has bounced again the huge block of stone and came back again. So it said this bomb has been planted outside. So what they did? They arrested the crew, which was sent to the Russian front. And as in the following morning, I mean, among the crew, there were some of the leaders, I think, who sort of looked so happy about not having to sail anymore in the Channel and being either bombed by the RAF or sunk by the Navy, that they'd been so happy that the Gestapo took them and shot them. Two of the leaders were shot. Then they shot the two sentries, which were supposed to have watched and didn't see any saboteur passing by and dropping this bomb. And then they sent the rest of the crew to the Russian front. So by the time, I think there was, we had sunk a ship, 4 Germans were killed, and the rest on the Eastern Front. That was what we could say.
And obviously you found this out by subsequent research. You wouldn't have known any of this at the time.
Yes, yes. Actually, Staunton is, of course, he had some intelligence with the police, local French, local police, and knew about it. And especially the Chantier de Normandie, because he knew he had some engineers working on the refitting ship, refitting of the Chantier de Normandie. And all this came true. I mean, the French people are aware, I mean, at a certain level of what happened.
Can we go on now about this time? Were you making preparations soon for D-Day?
Yes, especially in Le Havre. I was supposed to be the one who I had my missions was to. There was all the docks, the Havre docks were mined, And there was an electric circuit coming from the main post office of all the cables going to all the explosives which were laid by the Germans in the dry docks and the locks and the main cranes and all this and all that. And all this was collected, joined together and at the post office with a box. And I was supposed, just after D-Day, to go there and destroy this box. In a very difficult way, because the circuits were tested almost every day, 2 or 3 times a day, you know. They came to a main control room and they were tested. So what I was supposed to do is to destroy this junction box with acid. Managed to get underground, get to the junction box, and destroy it with acid. Just before, after D-Day, I don't know what. And so that to prevent, so that the harbor, which was the main one on the channel, to be used by the invading forces. As you know, that didn't happen, and really, there'd been some... The Havre was badly bombed out by the Canadians and the Americans, I think, and almost totally destroyed because of this. I don't know if I would have succeeded by that time.
Can you describe how the news of D-Day was received by the Réseau, members of the Réseau?
The whole Réseau was completely wiped out. In February, March 1944, it didn't exist anymore.
Can you describe how that happened, how it came about?
Yes. Well, I was personally, I'm going to a drop, I mean, near Elbe, for what's called, by the Fed Gendarmerie. And I managed to escape, but I was wounded by that time in war. So I left for England, of course, with Héricourt in February 1944, Henri Héricourt network. And then I went with Staunton, who were both of us, in London. He was supposed to jump in France in March after having spent. He was very, very tired indeed. And he spent about 3 months. Well, he spent about 1 month in London. And then he let me and said, OK, I'm jumping back in the field now to I've rested a bit, he said. And then he left one night and came back the following morning. And so, you know, I just nearly jumped into German hands. I mean, because the whole network has been wiped out. And actually, it was the Claude Malraux girlfriend. When he was arrested, and Peter Newman, who was our wireless operators, and all the other members of the network, one after the other. Catherine, this girl, managed to escape, and she went down to Dordogne. When André Malraux was, and Roland Malraux, these boyfriends, two brothers, and they managed to send a message, radio message, in time, it was before Staunton jumped, just in time. Otherwise, of course, the Germans had taken all the code books and the messages books, and everything, and it was actually operating a radio set. And this is what happened so many times with SOE, that anyone is supposed to be able to identify the operator by the way he actually manipulates. And of course, each radio operator has its special checks, you know, secret checks, which means two letters inside a group of letters, which were SS or etc. Which no one could know, and actually Peter Newman didn't tell about them. So, as usual, the German operator should have been identified by London. Secondly, that in what they did very, and I know that they did very often, I mean, when a group of letters were just forgotten by the, of course they couldn't be, they couldn't be mentioned by a fake operator because he didn't know about it. I had a message from London, oh, by the way, You have forgotten your security checks, which is SS in such place and all that. That happened, I know. Anyway, in our case, and what Peter Newman didn't actually use his set. There were no secret security checks, which were known only by him. And anyway, they sort of transmitted to London. There was a dialogue between the Germans in London for about, I don't know, maybe a fortnight at least. And they organized the reception committee for Staunton to jump into France, and they were waiting for him. All this was done. And fortunately, when they got the message from Henri Malraux, they said, okay, stop it. And he was stopped just on time, because before he boarded the plane. Otherwise, he would have been jumped into German hands.
How was it that you were wounded? Can you describe the incident?
Yes, because I was supposed to go to a drop in the Elbe-Frisia with still the same lorry we had, the gasoline one. And actually, I must say that the driver, I mean, had a bit too much to drink, and he couldn't definitely drive. So the chap in charge of the depot, I mean, said, okay, let's forget about the job. I said, it's impossible of it. I can't reach London right now. It was about 9 o'clock at night, or 7 or 8. We don't have any broadcasts. I mean, we can't do it. I couldn't catch with, yes, instead of using the lorry, we had an old motorbike, a small one, really small motorbike, you know, we could use by that time with a pass, anyway, a German pass. So, but I took off from Rouen very late, which was about 10:30, because I had expected this chap to come, and anyway, I sent for him all over the place, and they discovered him in a bistro, and he was really drunk, so... So I took this motorbike, and unfortunately, when I got nearly to Elbeuf, I was caught by the German police, because I was it was nearly curfew time. And on top of that, I had taken a member of our network to this, and he was on the 10th sad. And when I was stopped by the German car just behind, who overpassed me and stopped in front of me, as all police cars do, well, he jumped from the tent and he disappeared. So that is a bad position because the German... I said, okay, well, I've got my papers, I've got everything, I'm good, I'm first class. And what about the chap who's on the tent? Well, I said he was hitchhiking, I took him with me, but they didn't trust me, they didn't believe me. So one German took me to the car. There were about four of them in a car, you know. And and very, very fortunately, the gendarme who was supposed to ride the motorbike couldn't start it, you know, because anyway, I've closed the petrol tap, you know. And he said, well, I can start this damn thing, and okay, you ride, and we drive behind you with full lights on. And one of these German Feld gendarme, well, of course, took place on the tent set behind me with his Luger on my neck, which is very, very uncomfortable. As I didn't know the road, and there's nothing much I could do. I couldn't escape by a side road because I don't know them. And so I drove as far as the Feld gendarmerie with the car just behind me, you know, with four gendarmes and one with his pistol on my neck, which was very uncomfortable. And there was two buildings on the huge square. And one, I could identify one like the town hall and the other like the French gendarmerie. So when the car drove right to the French gendarmerie, as I didn't know anything, we just rode left to stop in front whatever the gendarme behind me was telling me in German. I said, I'm sorry, I don't speak German. And then, anyway, he left the... it was very cold. It was minus 10 centigrade Celsius. And then he left me, and he started walking towards the Feld gendarmerie. Well, I used the motorbike as a weapon anyway. I threw it as fast as I could. I mean, of course, he fell down from the motorbike on top of him and started racing like hell the other way, and they all started shooting, of course, and I got a bullet through me, that's all.
Where did it hit you?
Well, in the liver, in the lung, and all this, but I carried on running and racing until I got in the open air. I should say there was a small suburbs of Rouen, you know, and there was a railway bridge. I ran underneath the railway bridge, and I got lost in the fields in the near the Seine River. And, they left me because probably they were short of ammunition. They went back to the Feljandar and they fetched some ammunition and dogs, to police dogs, to chase me. So I had to, there was a small canal, not very wide, but I should say about 5 to 10 meters. So that the dogs lost my scent. I mean, I had to walk across this canal, which was very, very cold indeed, with water up to my chest. And then after that, I just lie down, and right in the center of the field, that was a good security with, which I just didn't forget anyway, so that in some cases, much better to be right in the open than be in bushes, especially in bushes. I mean, I knew that the dogs and police would go around this field and see through the bushes. So eventually, well, the dogs didn't scent me, and the German didn't find me at all. And I didn't die. I don't know what. I didn't die. I knew it later anyway, because the ducks had stolen me. I said, well, you should have been dead. But this dip in icy cold water, I mean, saved you, because it stopped the internal bleeding of the bicep. I mean, if you had a bullet right through your liver and right through the lung, I mean, you shouldn't have, in hot weather, you shouldn't have, you wouldn't have survived. It's impossible. You would have been bleeding to death. But the bleeding was stopped by the cold.
What did you do for a medical treatment?
Nothing. There was nothing. We couldn't.
No drugs? Anyway.
No, no drugs. There was nothing in France by that time. Of course, I had to. I walked back home, which is about 14 kilometers in the morning, at 5 o'clock in the morning when the curfew was up, after having spent, I was a real ice block. I fell on the ground and I was an ice block covered with ice. I mean, all stuck in ice. I couldn't hardly move.
And you just rested up for...
I rested up. I went to my safe house in Rouen, after having walked and watched the bridges to see if there was no German checkup on the bridges, you know, no roadblocks. There were no roadblocks, so I walked home. I went up there, and there was an old doctor belonging to our radio came to see me the day after. The night I managed to get the word to Claude Malraux and say, well, I've been hit. And I left the motorbike on the spot. So what they did the morning after, I mean, of course, they went to the police and reported that the motorbike had been stolen, which was the first thing to do. Then they sent me the doctor at night. And it was a very nice man, an old man, who said, well, he had no drugs, nothing at all. And of course, I couldn't go to hospital in Norway, so I was there. And he came to see me and said, okay, you rest. That's all you have to do. You seem to be all right. I mean, I said, I don't feel like smoking. I don't feel like eating. I've got a huge fever, too. And then he came to see me every night for about a week. And then after that, I felt better. And it was Christmas. Staunton, by that time, had left for England, but it was same thing. An attempt, he spent about one full night period, and no plane came. And when he came back to Rouen, he said, okay, next time I'll take you with me so that you can have medical checkup in London. So we spent a whole full night on the Loire River expecting a plane in January, and we left on the 4th or the 6th of February to London by Hudson, which was the last operation by Héricourt. When by the time that McMaster felt that it was a triple agent, and they stopped all the operation by Héricourt. That was it. It was like Hudson.
Can we now talk about Héricourt, and can you tell me when it was and how it was that you first met him?
I met him there. He was in charge of the... I met him in a cafe in Paris with Staunton, Avenue des Ternes, I think. because Staunton then took me to the icon and said, well, this is my assistant, this is Bob, and we're going to fly with you, with your line, which they called the line by that time, back to London. And I think the Erico said, okay, he was very friendly with Philip, with Staunton, because Staunton came to France once, and he went out already once with Erico, so they've met about two or twice already, and he liked Erico very much, because of course when the trip into France, or out of France, I mean, took several meetings as usual. I mean, it was the only way to meet at Héricourt to arrange for the flights. Where the meeting in Gare Montparnasse, which train we should take and where we should go to, a small village called Tiercé, which is 20 kilometers east of Angers, I think, on the Loire River, you know. So, when we were standing by in a small village in Tiercé, we met Derrico several times because he used to come and say, okay, the operation is for tonight or the operation is not for tonight, you know. And we used to play dice a lot with Derrico. He liked it. He was a very cheerful chap, very friendly. As you, Verity, say, he could seduce men and women. By the way, that was his character.
So you liked him?
Oh, yes. Well, I liked Henri and his the members of his team, which were Duménil, former Duménil, Clément, they were former Air France pilots, and Fatoum, there were four of them. Same chap. I mean, they were former pilots, very, very cheerful, always joking, playing cards, dice. When we met by that time, you know, we liked them very much. And anyway, we left on the 4th of February 1944.
Did you ever have any suspicions of him when you were in contact with him?
Not at all. Especially we didn't know anything about what happened anyway. What appear clear maybe now, of course, in 43 and 44, except for people being in London. I mean, whatever suspicion they had, they would talk the matter over in London, but not in the field. They didn't know anything.